Springfield's Talk 104.1. I am Nick Reed. It is our author of the week, as always, sponsored by incredible friends at ABC Books on North Glenstone. They have an entire author of the week section set up. And then we have our virtual author of the week at KSGF.com, where you can go back and listen to past interviews. Great resource for those of you that just finish a book, and instead of randomly asking people on social media, what should I read next? You can go listen to authors talk about their books. And we have Ryan Walters with us, the Jazz Age president defending Warren G. Harding. Thank you for being with us. And I'll ask, why Warren G. Harding? You know, there are more famous presidents that people know a little more about. I'd say most Americans probably know the name, but if you were to say, well, what was he known for? They probably wouldn't even know. So why Warren Harding?
Well, you're exactly right. Not only would they not know, the only thing they do know is negative things. They know he was the worst president ever, they've heard. I've heard people say, well, didn't his wife poison him? Wasn't his administration filled with corruption? They know that much because that's probably all they learned at high school or in college. But if you look at his real record, he's a lot better than that. He actually accomplished a great deal as president. So I wanted to write a book to sort of show who Warren Harding really was as a man and as a president. There's eight major myths that I go through in the book and discredit those myths. There's you know, a lot of falsehoods and lies around Warren Harding. So my task in this book was to try to straighten them out and to show he was actually a pretty good president when you look at his actual record and what he accomplished.
Well, let's talk about some of those myths and some that may be a little more well-known that people have heard and been taught in school. What are some of those that you learned of, discovered of, and wrote about in the book?
Well, there's eight of them, and I don't want to give them all of them away, but one of them, and he was dumb and not an intellectual guy. But when you read his letters, you don't see that at all. This was a guy that had a grasp of the issues and understood politics and played the game of politics very well. I went through a lot of his personal letters and political letters and things. He's a very smart man. He owned a newspaper. He was a journalist. Wrote a lot of editorials for years in the Marion Star. He was from Marion, Ohio. So I didn't find that to be true at all. They say he was a do-nothing president, didn't accomplish anything. That's certainly not true. They say when he was in the Senate, he didn't accomplish anything. And I show that he was instrumental in helping stop the League of Nations. They say he was nominated by a group of senators in a smoke-filled room, in a hotel room in Chicago. I disprove that. There are a whole host of things. There's myths around the scandals in his administration. Of course, the myth that his wife poisoned him. That's also untrue. So I try to go through the book and discredit all of that and use the actual sources available to us to show that most of this is untrue. A lot of it's political attacks. His political enemies threw this kind of stuff at him when he was in office. And so those things have persisted for 100 years, and historians have picked them up as fact and have run with them.
Well, that leads to my next question. You touched on it a little bit here. I mean, obviously, the information you gather and you cite sources so you can say, all right, well, this is how we know that this is accurate. How is it that even with historians, things seem to become so agreed upon, even though they are untrue?
All right. Well, a lot of this depends on your political persuasion. If you are a conservative, you're going to like conservative presidents. I mean, if you're a liberal Democrat, if you believe in those types of political policies, you're not going to like Warren Harding. You're not going to like Calvin Coolidge and Grover Cleveland and Thomas Jefferson. You're not going to like those kind of presidents. You're going to like FDR and Wilson. So a lot of these presidential rankings are based on that. And most of the historians in academia today or to the left. They're liberal Democrats. There's very few conservative Republicans in academia today, in higher education and history departments. So they tend to dominate, and they're the ones that write the textbooks. So that's what gets in these books. And so you need somebody with a different perspective on things to write a different story. Now, of course, people say, well, you're going to be tagged as a historical revisionist. Well, that's a word that they've, you know, tried to build up and make akin to conspiracy theory, you know, theorists. So, you know, they kind of throw it at you. So, in other words, you're departing from the accepted storyline. Of course, I don't care what you call me. You can call me whatever you want to. You know, let's argue with the facts in my book and argue with the facts of his administration, the true record, and you know, and quit the name calling.
We're talking with our author of the week, sponsored by ABC Books on North Glenstone, Ryan Walters, the Jazz Age president defending Warren G. Harding. You mentioned a few other presidents in there, and many of them are associated with the Great Depression, actually blamed for the Great Depression, as Harding often is as well. Is that accurate, and why does that blame lay at the feet of people like former President Harding?
Well, a lot of people, I had a professor one time who called it the Great Republican Depression. And, of course, you had a series of Republican presidents. You had Harding, Coolidge, and then Hoover. And the stock market crashed when Hoover was in office. And they lump Hoover in with Harding and Coolidge. But Hoover was nothing like Harding and Coolidge. Hoover was actually closer to FDR in his political philosophy. As a matter of fact, Hoover's the one that began reversing Harding and Coolidge's conservative policies in favor of more liberal policies and really made the Depression worse. But so what they try to do, and again, most of these guys are liberal Democrats, so they want to blame this on a Republican like Harding. And one historian wrote, he said, well, if you're going to give Harding and Coolidge credit for the boom of the 1920s, you have to give them credit for the bust that came afterwards. No, I don't. The real culprit was the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve withdrew a third of the money out of circulation from 1929 to 1933. Hoover and FDR tripled taxes, doubled spending. That's why Milton Friedman calls it the Great Contraction. There's your contraction right there. I tell people all the time, what if we did that today? What if the Federal Reserve withdrew a third of the money out of circulation in 4 years? Taxes were tripled and spending was doubled over its current level. You know what would happen to the economy? The same exact thing. So really it's the Federal Reserve that I believe deserves most of the blame. As a matter of fact, the Federal Reserve has admitted that. Ben Bernanke admitted it in 2004. Yeah, it was the Federal Reserve, the Fed, had caused most of the problems. But again, Hoover, FDR reversed Harding and Coolidge's policies, and that only made a depression, a Great Depression.
Our author of the week, Ryan S. Walters, an independent historian, teaches history at Collins College. People will think, well, all right, times are different, and what relevance does Harding even have to today? And one area of note, we always think that our moment in time often is like the first, and of course, the last couple of years we've seen between critical race theory, Black Lives Matter, all sorts of total social disruption, violent racial unrest. But this is something that he dealt with as president.
Yep, absolutely. I have a chapter in the book on the year 1919. And 1919 was a terrible year. There were a lot of terroristic attacks. Anarchist groups, Bolshevik groups were setting off bombs. There were labor strikes and labor problems across the country. But the worst part was called the Red Summer of 1919. It was a time of terrible racial violence. There were dozens of lynchings around the country that were pretty horrific. Harding came in 1920 and sought to calm that down. I have a chapter called Harding the Healer. And he called for equality for Black Americans. He called for a civil rights law. He called for a federal anti-lynching law. He went to Birmingham, Alabama, the heart of the old Confederacy, gave a speech, of course, to a segregated audience, but he said it's time to start giving equal rights and equal treatment for Black Americans. That was very courageous at the time to do. Nobody else would dare do anything like that. So Harding's record on civil rights and issues like that is very good. He doesn't get a lot of credit for it. He also helped restore the wounds of domestic tranquility caused by the wounds of World War I. Woodrow Wilson threw a lot of people in jail simply because they opposed the war. One of them was a socialist named Eugene Debs. He got a 10-year prison sentence because he opposed the war and gave a public speech opposing the war. Harding commuted his sentence and pardoned 23 other political prisoners and let them out of jail, and said this is the right thing to do. So he has a lot of that in his record that he doesn't get enough credit for either.
Before oftentimes do any sort of historical author interview, I try to first and foremost think, okay, what is it that I just remember from my education? And Teapot Dome, it just seems like one of those those things that are taught in school as a moment in history. Tell us about that, if you would.
It's a cool name. You know, we can remember Teapot Dome. It's got like the coolest name for a scandal, Teapot Dome, I guess, in Watergate. But really, as one scholar said, this scandal was really rather rinky-dink compared to some of the things we've seen since. All it amounted to was the Secretary of the Interior. The Navy had oil reserves that were set aside just for the Navy to run during a war. Naval ships ran on petroleum. So they had oil reserves in Elk Hills, California, Teapot Dome, Wyoming, set aside for the Navy. The Interior Secretary persuaded him to transfer those to his department. He then leased them to two private oil men and so they can drill. And he got $125,000 in bribes. That was the extent of it. Albert Fall was the Secretary of the Interior. And that was discovered. Harding discovered it just before he died. Harding died in office in 1923. It didn't really break until after he was already deceased. But Albert Fall was brought to trial, was convicted, given a prison sentence. He was the first cabinet member to go to prison. And the oil fields were restored back under government and Navy control. So, you know, by today's standards, it's rather rinky-dink. Now, there were a couple other scandals in his administration that Harding dealt with. There was one in the Veterans Bureau. The head of the Veterans Bureau was skimming profits on veterans' hospitals. He was fired and violently confronted by Harding in the White House. He went to prison, too. There was a scandal in the Justice Department. An individual there was selling pardons and other government favors. Harding was going to have him arrested for that, and the man went home and burned his papers and shot himself. So when Teapot Dome came along, it really broke Harding's heart. Harding was on a westward swing around the country, visiting people. He was the first president to visit Alaska. He discovered Teapot Dome. Herbert Hoover was on the trip with him, and he asked Hoover, "What should I do about this? And should I publicize it? What do we do?" And I think what he was thinking is, you know, when I confronted somebody in the Justice Department, they went home and killed themselves.
Right.
How do I handle this? And so I think he would have probably dealt with that when he got back from his trip. But he died in San Francisco on August the 2nd, 1923. So he never made it back to Washington. So it's a little unfair to criticize him for that before he had time to do anything about it. Of course, we do have to, you know, you have to give him a little bit of a black mark because he did appoint these guys to office, and presidents are responsible for who they appointed. But what I like to point out is he was doing something about these scandals as they came along. And Harding was a kind, generous man, and I think he trusted people a little bit too much. And it really hurt his feelings. It really broke his heart. Some people say he died of a broken heart because he just couldn't believe his friends would betray him like that and use the opportunity he had given them to loot the treasury. So he was a little too trusting of people. And, you know, and as we've learned, you really can't be that way, particularly in the government.
Well, and you mentioned the broken heart, but also referenced earlier rumors that he had been killed. He poisoned himself.
Right,
was that all rumor for the sake of rumor? How and why did that even start?
You know, again, he was coming back down the West Coast from Alaska. He got sick in Seattle. The doctor thought he had a stomach poison, like from bad seafood. They canceled his speeches in Portland. He went on to San Francisco. They put him in a hotel room there, and they got a heart specialist to come in because Harding had heart problems. And the heart specialist said, "I think you've had a mild heart attack. You need to rest here for a few days before you try to go anywhere." And he actually had a sudden stroke. His wife was reading to him. And he had a stroke and died suddenly on August the 2nd, 1923. And that rumor came out. There was a guy named Gaston Means that wrote a book called The Strange Death of President Harding. And he made that allegation. And he had been a former federal agent, and other members of the federal government said he was nothing but a con man. And even people who did not like Harding, did not like him at all personally or politically, even bristled with hostility over that and said there's no truth to that. You know, Florence Harding did not poison him. He didn't kill himself. He died exactly what was reported, which was a mild heart attack brought on with a stroke.
Our author of the week, Ryan Walters, the Jazz Age president, defending Warren G. Harding, of course, at ABC Books North Glenstone. You can get it there, sponsoring our author of the week. And then I'll mention you have family here in the area.
Yeah, my wife is a graduate of Marshfield High, a 1996 graduate of Marshfield High. And she was born in New Orleans, but she was raised in that area. So we're there several times a year. So I know Springfield and the surrounding area quite well. I've been there several times, and I'll be back again. I think in April we're going back, so to visit the in-laws.
Well, every Friday we do this show out at Scramblers, so you'll have to swing by. We'd love to have you on again. Ryan Walters, thank you so much, our author of the week.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Springfield's Talk 104.1. I'm Nick Reed.